That's what it's for.
Good morning to everyone. The first case this morning is Motes versus Republican Party of Nebraska. Mr. Domina, good morning.
Good morning. May it please the court, I'm Dave Domina. I'm here on behalf of Rex Motes. Your Honor, since Nebraska became a state, the First Amendment has stood for one proposition. Speech is free as long as speech is true. In this case, Rex Motes declared himself as a candidate for the nonpartisan Nebraska legislature, and he was faced with a series of publications described in the pleadings, publications by the Republican Party. Those publications repeatedly say that Mr. Motes signed and filed in a court a false affidavit. They accuse him of a crime. Four of them do. They also accuse him of taking $50,000 in trust money from an insurance company that had failed and couldn't pay its policyholders. The truth of the matter is that Mr. Motes blew the whistle on the insurance company. His activity led to its receivership. He was the first employee of that insurance company engaged by the receiver, KPMG, with a court order, and he was the last employee to leave that receivership. He served it throughout its entire course as it liquidated to protect policyholders. Mr. Motes offered himself for public service. He ran in a nonpartisan campaign for a nonpartisan office, an office that was conceived by a Nebraskan, George Norris, who understood that the purpose of a nonpartisan legislature was to keep national party politics out of the process. Our legislature still proudly proclaims that on its website, in its homepage. Well, that's not the way it worked. These publications each bear the name, the mailing stamp, and the number of the publication of a major Nebraska political party, the party we've sued. That party conceived and designed these products to influence an election. That's the business the political party is in. Its purpose, its function, its organization, its reason for collecting money, hiring staff, paying payroll, sponsoring conventions, having a business manager, is to engage in the business of politics. Mr. Motes believes he has a remedy under Section 59-1602 as a result. He believes that the major political parties of this state, including the one he sued here, engage in trade or commerce. And that trade or commerce obviously affects Nebraskans. In this instance, it affected Nebraskans as they exercised their franchise to vote and made an effort to select a constitutional officer. And in that process, they were misled because the political party that is the defendant here engaged in deception. The statute forbids deception. It uses the word deception. It engaged in a false practice, which is forbidden by the statute. Now, the party says it doesn't engage in trade or commerce. Your sister courts, most recently Michigan, have observed that the political process, including the activity of political parties, involves the expenditure of billions of dollars. In our state, about 35,000 people are represented by each state senator, one of 49. Our campaigns routinely cost here $300,000 or $400,000 per candidate now because of expenditures for products exactly like this. Mr. Motes lost the election. No problem. No problem. That's not the complaint. It's not about the outcome. He didn't make any attempt to intervene before the election was over and the people had spoken. He's here because he was lied about, because he wants an opportunity to prove that to a jury and to vindicate himself. He did not sign or give a false affidavit.
When you opened your remarks with the reference to the false affidavit, and how many publications do you believe that appears in?
It appears in four, Your Honor. It appears in publications 2, 3, 4, and 6. 6, for example, Mr. Moats claimed in an affidavit that National Warranty was doing financially well.
I have that in Publication 3.
That's also in Publication 3, Your Honor. I think exactly the same language. I happen to be reading from 6.
All right.
I think you're right. Publication 4 is the one that we put in its entirety in our complaint, cut and pasted a picture of it. That's the one that purports to be a letter from Mr. Moats in which he talks about his affidavit.
Are these things you allege are defamation per se? Is that?
Those are, Your Honor. Those accuse him of committing
a crime. So which publications would those be?
2, 3, 4, and 6 mention the affidavit.
The appellee in the brief argues that these publications are not actionable because they're either opinion, satire, or hyperbole. What's your response to that?
Mr. Moats, you've signed a false affidavit. That is not satire.
So that's where you're focusing is on the false affidavit?
That's the easy part, Your Honor. Those we should prevail on for sure. Those, I think, are the simplest for the court. The harder part are the other publications. And as you know from our complaint and our brief, one of the publications, number 10, we selected to put in the complaint and acknowledge that it's not defamatory and said that it's actionable under our other theories. So our purpose for that, frankly, was to get a pleading before the court below, and now you, that raises the unfair competition issue. We think on defamation we win, we're entitled to reversal clearly. We cite some cases from Connecticut, North Carolina, where there have been similar holdings. We don't know of one that involves the unfair competition provision of Section 59.1602 or its analogous provision in other states.
What's your response to Appley's comments with respect to either that appellant did or did not seek leave to replead and so forth?
Well, number one, the rule says that we can request leave at any time. As the court knows, there is no record of proceedings below. As far as the court knows, there wasn't even a hearing held. The court just ruled on the motion. So we seek leave now, since we can do that at any stage. Number two, at the time this case was decided, and the governing precedent, I think, was from the Court of Appeals in Bailey versus First National Bank of Chadron, which holds that a trial court must announce a reason why it does not automatically grant leave to dismiss if it dismisses without leave.
But did that case go more to abuse of discretion rather than requiring a ruling on amending?
Is your question about Bailey, Your Honor?
Yeah.
As I recall, Bailey, what happened was that there was no question about a request for leave. The trial court simply dismissed without announcing any reason why or suggesting whether it would or not would not entertain
so
leave.
I beg your pardon, but in this case, then, is this correct that the first time request to amend is being made at the appellate level?
It may be, but it's also clear from the record that this is our first opportunity to request leave. We got an order dismissing.
Well,
are we supposed to anticipate dismissal?
I suppose you could file a motion for reconsideration and ask leave to amend. Couldn't you do that at the trial level?
We could have, Your Honor, but you know our practice doesn't include a motion for reconsideration. I know they're commonly used, but we don't have a rule that authorizes them. I'd like to.
It never stopped a lot of other people.
I understand it hasn't, but maybe it should. That's why we have rules. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Graz, good morning.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Steve Graz and I represent the Appellee Nebraska Republican Party. Your Honors, this appeal concerns review of an order granting a motion to dismiss a complaint under Nebraska Rule of Pleading 6-1112B6. It presents several issues of first impression, including whether a district court has a duty, sua sponte, to grant leave to amend where no motion was filed, and whether application of Nebraska's rules of pleading will continue to follow the federal rules of civil procedure for purposes of both stating a claim and determining the sufficiency of a claim. Your Honor, the appellant in this case has chosen to stand on his complaint as pled and has waived any ability to amend it.
And
assigned error number
what,
five.
What, yes, Your Honor. What record shows that, just by the fact that they didn't ask for a motion to amend?
Yeah, yes, Your Honor. The appellant's brief claims that they, quote, leave to amend was sought but not granted. However, no motion for leave was filed. There's absolutely nothing in the appellate record to support that assigned error. There simply was no motion filed.
What motion would you suggest should have been filed? I mean, the dismissal occurred by the court, did it not?
Yes, Your Honor. I believe they could have filed a motion for a new trial, a motion for reconsideration, encompassing a motion for leave to amend at that point. The appellant seems to argue that the trial court had a duty on its own to grant leave to amend sua sponte upon issuing an order.
Excuse me, you're backing up on the procedure on what type of motion. Do the federal jurisdictions, do they have a rule to allow to seek amendment after a dismissal?
Well, Rule 15A, of course, is a motion to amend the pleadings afterwards, I guess a motion for a new trial, alleging errors in the court's order.
But there was no new trial here. There was no trial, so it couldn't be a motion for a new trial.
That's correct, Your Honor. There was a hearing held, and the appellate record before the court, consisting of the order of the district court, states that a hearing was held.
And there is no such thing as a motion for reconsideration.
That is true. I think it is commonly, there are motions certainly commonly made.
Those are usually done in the context after a hearing and a decision, either, well, not on the pleadings, but some type of a decision, isn't that?
Normally, I guess that would be the case. Certainly, I would have filed a motion for leave to amend in this situation.
Well, you may want to go to the merits. We'll grapple with the procedure.
I would point out that no reported Nebraska decision has held that failure to grant leave to amend sua sponte is an abuse of discretion.
Under the old pleading rules, weren't there cases holding that ordinarily leave to amend should be granted when a demur is sustained?
Yes, Your Honor, and that's an important distinction because the new rules no longer make a leave to amend a right. In fact, they say that leave may only be granted upon leave of court or upon stipulation with opposing counsel. So there's a distinction in the rules there. It's no longer a matter of right.
So, but we review for abuse of discretion?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
We would review for abuse of discretion if a motion were filed and the court denied. We would review.
Yes, Your Honor. That would be the standard of review. A second threshold issue in this appeal is the standard under which the sufficiency of the appellant's complaint must be reviewed. The standard for stating a claim was recently clarified by the U.S. Supreme Court in Ashcroft versus Iqbal. A complaint must contain enough facts to show that the plaintiff is entitled to relief. The Supreme Court's decision brings clarity to how Rule 8A2 should be applied in the context of a motion to dismiss a claim under Rule 12B6. The court held that a pleading that offers labels and conclusions or formulaic recitations of the elements will not do. Nor does a complaint suffice if it tenders naked assertions devoid of further factual enhancement. The guidance from the Supreme Court is critical in consideration of the present appeal, since previously a complaint could be dismissed only in a motion, a 12B6 motion, if it appeared beyond doubt that the plaintiff could prove no set of facts that would demonstrate an entitlement to relief. Under that standard, Your Honors, Nebraska judges literally had to use their imaginations to conjure up facts a plaintiff could prove in order to state a claim. Conjuring up facts for a plaintiff does not meet either the plain language of Rule 6-1108-A2 or the Supreme Court's interpretation of Federal Rule 8-A2 in Ashcroft. Although Ashcroft is a U.S. Supreme Court case, it may and should be followed by this court. In Kellogg versus Nebraska Department of Correctional Services, and other cases, this court stated that because the new rules of civil pleading are modeled after the federal rules of civil procedure, we look to the federal decisions for guidance. Thus, the no set of facts standard can no longer be considered valid. The first theory of recovery set forth in Moat's complaint is made under 59-1602, and that was discussed by counsel. That is part of the Nebraska Consumer Protection Act. However, Moat's complaint does not allege any acts or conduct that are actionable under that act. The section of the act relied upon by Moat applies, by its express terms, only to commercial activity. Not only does Moat's complaint fail to identify any commercial activity, it admits the challenged publications are campaign literature. Therefore, the matter at issue concerns political speech, which is subject to a very different legal standards. 59-1602 is a penal statute. It cannot be interpreted as regulating or applying to political speech since it contains no malice element. The analogous federal case law on this issue is directly on point and is dispositive of that claim.
Do you have something to say with respect to the Michigan case to which opposing counsel referred?
I'm not sure which case is referring to, but I believe, Your Honor, they were simply talking about in terms of campaign finance, how much money is spent on campaigns, which is certainly true. But that, however, does not convert campaign literature into commerce.
Does the Consumer Protection Act apply to activities that would affect just one individual as opposed to the state as a whole?
Well, I think it is true that this was campaign material that was disseminated to an entire legislative district.
Well, but it's directed at one individual. Does one candidate have protection under the Consumer Protection Act if it affects only one candidate?
Certainly, Your Honor, there's no precedent ever holding that statute applicable in that context. And the analogous federal case law under the Lanham Act, which is almost identical, even using the same word, expressly holds that it is not actionable in the context of political speech. I'd like to turn briefly to the false light invasion of privacy claim. A false light claim is actionable in Nebraska only if the false light in which the person is placed would be, quote, highly offensive to a reasonable person. Now, the only paragraph in Mr. Moat's complaint purporting to state a claim for false light is paragraph 38. That paragraph fails to make even a recitation of that required element, let alone any allegation as to why a reasonable person would find it highly offensive. The words that were alleged in the complaint. In addition, to be actionable, a false light claim must be based on published assertion of facts and not opinion.
Suppose I were running for state treasurer and the slogan came out, "You can't trust this man with your money." Would that be actionable?
No, Your Honor. That would be a rather textbook example of political speech that is considered hyperbole and the totality of circumstances test, which this court applies,
it might imply that he would not spend it wisely. It wouldn't imply that he would steal it.
Absolutely. And before I run out of time, Your Honor, I would just like to address a couple of statements made by opposing counsel. Basically, opposing counsel attempted to rewrite the complaint here this morning by stating that the complaint alleges that the defendant accused Mr. Moats of making a false affidavit. That word does not appear anywhere in the complaint. It does not appear anywhere in the challenged literature.
But don't you have to read the allegations as a whole? Would you put a shady insurance company based in the Cayman Islands ahead of Nebraska consumers? You wouldn't, but Moats did. And then how did Moats mislead creditors and the public? Rex Moats claimed in an affidavit that National Warranty was doing financially well. So, isn't that saying he filed a leading one to believe that he filed a false affidavit?
It says he filed a misleading affidavit. There's a big difference between misleading and false. Personally, I've seen many affidavits that were misleading that were not perjury. Therefore, you get into defamation per quad, not defamation per se, and all of the implications that has for the rules of pleading. Thank you.
Thank you. Do we have time for rebuttal?
Yes, we have a minute and 14.
A minute and 14 seconds, Mr. Domina.
Your Honors, in paragraphs 15, 18, 21, 22, and 23 of the complaint, Mr. Moats alleges that the statements made against him are false. In paragraph 18, he says he did not make a false or misleading affidavit. Today, the party who he has sued cites a case in which a terrorist and a suspected prisoner of war sued the Attorney General of the United States and was held to have filed a complaint that was not colorable and was therefore dismissed on a Rule 12 motion. This is a Nebraska lawyer who offered himself for public service for a nonpartisan office and expected simply to run in a campaign setting in which the sides contesting would be held to the truth. That's all. He didn't terrorize anybody, and he shouldn't have been terrorized. He should have his day in court. The important part of this is reining in political activity run amok. Section 59.16.02 will do that. In Eicher versus Mid-America Financial, you awarded attorney's fees and held that statute applies in a case in which, in 8 distinct instances, people were contacted about financing, leasing, and having options on their homes, and you held there was a public interest. There's certainly one here. Thank you.
Thank you. The next case for the day is Vitalix Inc. versus